IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We're a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring a fresh perspective to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
I'm Shri Khanna, and you are listening to All Things Policy. Central Asia has an important place in the wider discussion on geopolitics. Some analysts have called it the iron frame of Eurasia, mainly because of its potential as a transshipment hub connecting various parts of the globe. It is no wonder that great power politics in recent memory has featured countries contesting rivalries over it, be it Anglo-Russian contention in the Great Game, or post-Soviet attempts of Russia to maintain its influence and the war in Afghanistan, etc. So, in this context, Kazakhstan, a former Soviet country, which is seen as a linchpin to the region, was suddenly rocked by protests and unrest, which saw the intervention of Russia and Collective Security Treaty Organization, CSTO. To discuss these latest developments, I am joined by my colleague, Gavin Marine, who is going to talk about this continental quagmire. So welcome, Gavin Marine, a.k.a. Aditya Parikh.
Thanks, Shrek.
So Aditya, it is the first time in history that the CSTO is intervening in an armed conflict. So to tell our listeners, what are the origins of the CSTO and the role that it is supposed to play in regional security? Because previously we did not hear much about the CSTO, and then suddenly there are a lot of developments. Initially, the Iran was made part of it, and now this intervention is happening. So what exactly is CSTO and the role that it is supposed to play in maintaining regional security?
Okay, so as you rightly pointed out, the Central Asian region is very important to the larger debate on geopolitics, and Russia being one of the major players in the world, the former Soviet countries that it considers its compatriots are very important to the regional security. And Russia, like all great powers, has this tendency to, you know, keep its friends close. And just as China has the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, Russia has the CSTO, the Collective Security Treaty Organization. So if you look at its major participants, you'll find that there are six countries there: Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Russia, and Tajikistan. And there used to be Azerbaijan, Georgia, Uzbekistan also there. And as you pointed out, Iran was also invited to join at one point, but Iran isn't currently a member. And there are observers, say Serbia is one of the observers. But, you know, the kind of partnership that CSTO looks for is about security cooperation over external threats. So it's not really an organization about quelling internal dissent or threats which are about homeland security per se, but rather external aggression against one of the member states. So the very same way that any other military alliance or a security alliance, like a military part of SCO or...
like NATO would work, right?
Yeah, NATO would be an example. But, you know, CSTO, I wouldn't really compare NATO to CSTO, because CSTO is a lot more about, the kind of things that were the security community across the world's obsession. For example, terrorism or, you know, nuclear security, that sort of a thing. So I wouldn't really think of NATO being an exact equivalent to CSTO, because while the paradigm is very similar, the priorities of the two organizations are very different. So for example, I think one of the Russia watchers that I follow, Sergei Radchenko, pointed out that, hey, this is at least this much is proven that this is a defensive kind of an organization. It only invades itself. So it's not as if it's aimed at invading any other place, but rather it's there to protect the interests of its own member states. So Russia deploying troops to Kazakhstan, Belarus deploying troops to Kazakhstan, and the Russian leadership feeling worried about its partners in the Tokayev government, it really is a different paradigm from, NATO, where you wouldn't really see, so for example, Donbass, you wouldn't really see the UK deploying troops to the Donbass to go and fight in the frozen conflict there. But here, if a call was made by the Tokayev government to safeguard the constitutional order, the Belarusians and the Russians responded, the CSTO responded, and, you know, Armenia's prime minister, who you would remember from headlines last year during the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, you'd remember him from there. He is currently the chair of CSTO, and he took on the call that President Tokayev of Kazakhstan asked for assistance, and he put the matter right in front of CSTO immediately, and the approval was given quite fast. You know, I wouldn't expect NATO to move so fast, because firstly, there are more members and there are divergent geopolitical interests at some points, sans Turkey. So I don't think a joint NATO action would come as fast as the CSTO responded in this situation. So yeah, I think they are two very different organizations, but yeah, there are parallels. So the regional security situation because of CSTO, I think in Russia's backyard, you know, Russia doesn't really, the final point that I'd like to make with this answer is, Russia doesn't really treat CSTO the same way that, say, the United States, which is in a very similar leading role in its alliance, NATO, treats NATO. Because Russia also thinks ahead in terms of, you know, diplomacy, in terms of securing interests which are more than immediate. So, for example, Russia has signed a multilateral treaty with all of its CSTO partners, which is about the non-placement of first weapons in outer space. I don't think that NATO would have such a multilateral treaty beside its charter. So that sort of a thing, I don't think NATO has pursued, or the US-led order in the transatlantic security situation has pursued.
Yes, thank you for correcting me on Iran. I misspoke. It actually, Iran became part of SCO, not CSTO. So yeah, also NATO, I think you are right. And I think the bigger reason for that differentiation between NATO and CSTO is that because CSTO, they actually come from one empire, the Soviet Union, right? And NATO, they were all different countries always before the collapse of Soviet Union, and the later the some post-Soviet republics joined. So yeah, they are different type of treaty organizations. Okay, so I want to ask about the nature of these protests. So how did these protests start, and how did they develop into this unrest? And there is also, we keep hearing about the hybrid war, info war angle. So is there any militia leader who is leading the charge against the government? Or was this the simmering yet organic discontent against the government, which, you know, came to fore with the rise in oil prices? What exactly happened?
So that's a very difficult question to answer, because honestly, the protest started peacefully. This much is, you know, consensus. Even from the Tokayev government and the Western observers, or just about anybody, even the independent observers I would trust, everybody agrees that yes, they were about popular discontent about energy prices and the widespread inequality in society, which has been a factor in Central Asia and other parts of the world. It's not really a very Kazakhstan only problem. This has been a problem everywhere in the world to various degrees. But the thing is, the kind of, you know, speed at which things move. So I think the protest started as unrest around the 4th, between the 4th of January and the 6th of January. But peaceful protests were going on since the 2nd of January. And the 1st of January was when the whole matter started, really, when the energy prices were increased. So, I mean, energy prices are a problem in Europe as well, but you don't see a lot of, you know, violent clashes over it right now. But the situation could change for any country And, you know, there's this fear in the former Soviet space that a lot of strategic documents even talk about for the countries that are part of the region, the phenomena of color revolutions. So popular discontents end up overthrowing regimes, introducing instability in these countries. It's really something that the security apparatus of those countries takes seriously. And I think these protests were a bit murky in that sense, because, you know, as of now, the information that has come out about them had a lot of angles, had a lot of gray areas. I'd say you can't really point to one spark actually burning down the whole forest, because here there were a bunch of interests which just, you know, snowballed, and a lot of people co-opted the issue. And, you know, there were people who tried to introduce disinformation, misinformation about what exactly was going on. Even the Tokayev regime, I wouldn't specifically say that was very upfront about the situation. And definitely at one point there was quoting numbers which were honestly wild. Thousands of casualties were being reported by various sources, but the number of casualties wasn't exactly accurate as reported by the Tokayev government. And there was a lot of co-opting by actors which weren't exactly, you know, official representatives of the protesters, or there wasn't really a grapevine or a chain of command or any kind of a structure to these protests, which, you know, snowballed into unrest. So I don't think we have a lot to say that this is where it started, this is the person that's leading it, and this is the group that it's commonly associated with. There's no popular front here. There are a lot of actors. And so the hybrid war and info war angle, I think it really is about how information has come out of the country. So when you look at the kind of speculation that started forming because of CSTO actually sent troops. So, you know, at this point, I'd also like to talk about the specific numbers that were sent in. So Russia contributed around 3,000 troops. Belarus sent about 500. Tajikistan about 200, and Armenia about 70. So these troops, these numbers came out, you know, on January 6th, I think. And the sources were, as far as I understand, journalists from Kyrgyzstan. And at the time, you know, this information wasn't reliable, but after a while, it became clear that CSTO wasn't staying. But that did not stop Western analysts, Western watchers from, you know, speculating that, hey, could this be a quagmire where CSTO and Russia could make a strategic blunder and, you know, get kind of like how the frozen conflict in Donbas is currently, or Afghanistan in the Soviet era was a quagmire. So either situation could have happened was the judgment of quite a lot of people in the West. But none of that happened. And the CSTO contingent, as we speak, is withdrawing. So if I recall correctly, on the 13th, it was announced that the CSTO troops would move out of the country within 10 days. And they've been moving out. There are videos of the Belarusian and the Russian contingents of the CSTO peacekeepers flying back to their home countries. And honestly, I think the way the West has, you know, commented on it. So, for example, there was an official US government statement, I think by Antony Blinken, if I recall correctly. So he said that if you invite Russians into your home, they don't so easily leave. So, well, that didn't come true. As you can see, the Russians are in the process of leaving. And this has been one of those most efficient deployments of any force in the world. I mean, the situation might still evolve in the future, but as of now, the unrest has been quelled. And to quote President Tokayev of Kazakhstan, constitutional order has been restored. And although there was a lot of damage to life and property, but the kind of catastrophic situation that this could have led to, the worst fears weren't realized. And that too, really, I think the credit belongs to the Tokayev government asking CSTO and CSTO readily agreeing, which is basically, as I said, it's a Russia-led organization. It's a Russia-led alliance. So a lot of credit belongs to the Kremlin's good sense that they would protect their assets inside Kazakhstan. So, I mean, I should really mention it that there are major assets which Russia's military technical infrastructure relies on a lot of installations in Kazakhstan. And there's the Baikonur Cosmodrome, which is basically a spaceport from where Russia launches a lot of their commercial space missions. So it's a very important strategic asset for Russia. And there had to be troops on the ground to protect it. And there is other infrastructure too, which needed protecting for Russia's larger interests in the region. It really was an efficient operation. And now that the troops are withdrawing, as the CHTO peacekeepers, those troops are withdrawing, we can call this a success, I think.
Interesting. You're right. I think this is one of the most efficient in and out type of operation in recent times, especially when you contrast it with the other such operations which the US was involved in. Now, okay, so I think we should take a break, and after the break, we are going to continue our conversation. Welcome to this episode of All Things Policy. I'm Shrekhanna and I'm joined by Aditya Parikh. So Aditya, we talked about CSTO, its origin, and the hybrid info war angle and the nature of protests that had happened. Now, I want to focus in on the politics in Kazakhstan. So what is this rivalry between the president Qasym Tokayev and the other guy, Nur Sultan Nazarbayev? And in this context, who's supporting whom? I mean, who is close to Putin and Russia? Because Russia believes that it is the West which is fomenting color revolution. So if this is the case, you think who's supported by the US, any leader or a group or an NGO? And what is this exact nature of support from the US that had made Putin so convinced that there is already, some sort of a meddling going on by the West?
Yeah, so I don't think that the US has a very, defined horse to back in any sort of a contention in Kazakh politics. And saga with Nur Sultan Nazarbayev goes right back to Soviet times during Gorbachev's time. So Nur Sultan Nazarbayev used to be the head of the Kazakh Soviet Republic. And at the time when the dissolution of the Soviet Union happened, he emerged as the leader of independent Kazakhstan. And he was president until very recently, when he was president for about 29 years since 1991. So he served, as the only option for Kazakh politics for a long time. And it was really about a kind of a regime where, this is really a tale that's been told quite a few times, how appropriation of state assets once the Soviet Union was no more was really, kind of operation where whoever was in charge of those assets just appropriated it for themselves and distributed it almost impunity at one point in the 90s. That really never stopped in Kazakhstan until very recently. And I'm not sure it would ever stop in the regime that's in power right now. So the effective transfer of power between Nur Sultan Nazarbayev and president happened very recently. And at one point, it was seen as this sort of a retirement plan for Nur Sultan Nazarbayev, that he would, serve as this father figure kind of deal to Kazakhstan. And he would serve on the Security Council for life. And the everyday administration would be left to Tokayev. So that was the arrangement until very recently. But after the events of the past 2 weeks, things took a turn which nobody expected. As unexpected as the Soviet collapse was to the whole world, similarly, this unrest was just as unplanned and unforeseen for just about everybody, including Russia and the CSTO. So Nur Sultan Nazarbayev and a lot of members of his clan, his close associates and his family members were a part of the state machinery. And it can be said that there was a lot of misappropriation of state assets, to put it lightly. And a lot of the wealth of the state was actually owned by just a few people, almost 55% or more of Kazakhstan's wealth was owned by people who were very close to Nursultan Nazarbayev. So it was really a system that, kleptocracy would be the word for it, but, interests are interests and geopolitics is geopolitics. So it wasn't really in the US's interest to, call this a regime which was unfriendly to it, because the threat that the US sees from Russia getting Kazakhstan completely in its orbit, which might be inevitable now, you just don't know what side the Tokayev regime is going to wake up on in this after this quagmire. So I don't really see that the US is the only actor here. Russia has also great links to Kazakhstan, firstly because it considers it a compatriot country in the Commonwealth of Independent States. Russia has this relationship with Kazakhstan where there's a lot of security cooperation, and there's also the economies of the two countries are so interlinked that you can't separate one from the other. So the workers who contribute to the Russian economy, who are migrant workers, and it's not just Kazakhstan, but a majority of them also come from Kazakhstan. And the Russian economy, even during COVID, had a really hard time with its functioning because migrants couldn't really as effectively travel to Russia and work. So, it's so interlinked that Russia's interests and the US interests are kind of competing there at the moment. And, if I talk a few specific things, so even in the security agreements that Kazakhstan has with Russia, so there's a bilateral agreement that it has over, and this is separate from CSTO. Russia provides a lot of training to the Kazakh armed forces, and they conduct joint drills, and they exchange information over, threats that are of interest to both countries. And they also have similar agreements with, Kazakhstan has similar agreements with countries in NATO. And say, for example, I was reading this piece by Eurasia, and it mentions that they have a similar plan for a cooperation with Italy, which is a NATO member, and they've also bought drones from Turkey, which is another NATO member. So it's not really that Kazakhstan is only reliant on Russia for everything, but its interests are really far-reaching, and it wouldn't be right to say that the US has the upper hand or Russia has the upper hand in that country. So it really remains to be seen if the Tokayev government is going to align more closely to which side. Now,
okay. So from what I gather, Nazarbayev was made to retire, and then that is the source of what's the sort of rivalry between him and Tokayev, right?
Well, I wouldn't say that he was made to retire, because we honestly at the moment don't know where Nursultan Nazarbayev is, because the information is scarce, and there have been a slew of articles, a slew of communications which don't feature him specifically. We haven't seen him in the flesh. So we just don't know what's happening with him.
I am reminded of one guy called Mullah Khandzada. And he's also very, it's impossible to see him. And he's the head of Taliban. And after Taliban victory is yet to be seen. Now we listen to sometimes his sound bites, they come out. And this, I think this is a Central Asian thing. The seniors, they kind of disappear. Okay, coming back to the topic. Barik, this is happening in Central Asia. And if we again zoom out of the domestic politics in Kazakhstan, then in Central Asia, we know that Russia and China, they compete for influence. And this competing influence is there. But despite this competition, there is also that pragmatic alliance between Russia and China, especially against the US hegemony. So what kind of a balance you see right now, their collaboration, are they collaborating or competing What is China's relationship with Russia in context to this Kazakhstan protest?
So the CSTO intervention was definitely, you know, undoubtedly lauded by the SCO. So there's a specific statement that the Secretary General of SCO put out. They said that the SCO pays close attention to the development of the situation, and they expressed concerns about the street riots and illegal activities, and they expressed their support for measures to restore stability and initiate peaceful dialogue within the framework of constitution and the legal system. And they noted the deployment of the CSTO peacekeeping forces for temporary tasks, emphasizing the importance of stability in Kazakhstan for maintaining regional peace, expressing hope for restoration of legal order and public security, protection of rights and interests of ethnic and religious groups. So that statement that I just read the text out of, it really is comprehensive, and it shows you that, you know, people were the Western observers. If I recall correctly, Sergei Radchenko, who I mentioned earlier in the podcast, he had this idea that as fast as the CSTO moved in approving this intervention, they would barely have the time to, you know, consult with China. And this could have led to a kind of situation where, you know, it would have been kind of, you know, emergent to cause for friction if the Chinese would have been, you know, for the lack of a better word, stupid to undermine Russia's legitimate interest in safeguarding its neighborhood. But that didn't happen. The Chinese are smart, apparently. And the Shanghai Cooperation Organization came out in support of the CSTO's intervention. And well, the wedge that to the West would have preferred, and honestly, I would have preferred to see between China and Russia, I would say that didn't happen. The Chinese have very smartly, you know, taken in the lesson that, you know, you have to make concessions to your allies when it's important. We don't have any evidence if they were consulted beforehand or post facto. We just don't know what happened between the SCO and the CSTO. But if the two organizations are speaking in the same tone on the issue, I think the lesson to be learned here is that this wasn't an opportunity where you could drive a wedge between Russia and China. So as I would represent the Indian national interest, I think it's really not the place where we would find any opportunity for our ally, Russia, to be drawn away from our adversary, China. So I think we would have to just find opportunities elsewhere.
Yeah, I think that'll be the case. This is not happening right now. But yeah, there are problems, structural problems between China and Russia. So let's see when they have a fallout. Lastly, one final thing that I would like you to talk about is, what are your views on the future of Kazakhstan? Because we had Taliban takeover in August last year in Afghanistan, and which had made the situation in Central Asia quite unstable with all the factional infighting that happens in among the Taliban. And now with this situation in Kazakhstan, so what is the outlook for, you know, future?
Hey, so I don't really see a very catastrophic situation going forward. Because, you know, the Tokayev government, although a lot of people have been changed in key positions in the state, I don't really think that the system would shift to a different paradigm, and that would be detrimental to Kazakhstan's interests or the interests of Russia in the region or just about any other player. So I don't think there's going to be a humanitarian catastrophe on the scale of the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan has ushered in. So I think there's in the short term going to be some measures to, you know, address the popular discontent, the rising prices of the cost of living in the country and the inequalities in the country. And since the Nursultan Nazarbayev clan seems to be losing, and the Tokayev government is now putting people it trusts in those key stations where a lot of, you know, misappropriation of state funds might have happened in the past. So I think things might actually turn better for the populace of Kazakhstan in the short term. The medium and long term, I'm not really, you know, confident in making a judgment on where the tide would turn, just what would happen. And honestly, even the current situation, I think key facts are going to come out in a while. It could be a year, it could be 10 years, I'm not sure. But we would know more about what exactly happened in this fateful week between the 2nd of January to the 7th and 7th or 8th of January, when the constitutional order for the major part of the country was restored, as President Tokayev said. So I think a lot is yet to be uncovered, and only then it would make sense to, you know, to judge if the country is headed for better times or worse times. So I think it's really a space we should watch for the moment.
Yes, it's an interesting space. Thank you, Parikh, for coming to the show. So if you like today's discussion, do check out our past discussions on all things policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle, @TakshashilaInst, or our website, takshashila.org.in.
Hey, hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.